This sermon has been in the works for quite a while. In fact, I read an entire book in preparation for this sermon, but it started out as a split sermon in Texarkana. And when I gave it in Texarkana, I told them that I was writing this split sermon specifically toward them because of so much sickness and trials that they've gone through in the Neff family in recent times. And I said, I just felt very strongly that I wanted to give them something directed right at them at the time. And then, as it would happen, I started getting more ideas to build that split into a sermon. And so I added maybe 15 pages to the sermon and gave it in Ruston. And I was thinking about giving it the next time I speak here, which is, I think, in a few weeks. But then Dr. Ward contacted me and wanted to know if I was up to speaking, and I said I'd rather be standing for an hour than sitting for an hour, because I'm very much more comfortable vertically than bent in half. And so I said I will welcome the chance to stand. So when he contacted me, I instantly thought about the sermon, and all of the ideas started flowing back into my mind of what I wanted to do to that sermon, to change it, to add to it. And so there's about 5 more pages that have been added last night over several hours of editing, and a different front end was worked on and so forth. So this is not exactly what I gave the other two locations, but what I just went through, and I thought, the timing is right. So, let's get on with the sermon then, now that you have the background. The title of the sermon is Job's Wife. It's a little bit different kind of sermon than you've heard probably from me. Job's Wife. Does life just get you down sometimes? Are there times when nothing seems to work and you're overwhelmed by how much turmoil and sadness you're experiencing? Let's start today by turning over to Psalm 61, and we'll read the first couple of verses there of Psalm 61. This kind of sets the theme for the whole sermon. Psalm 61, beginning in verse 1. Hear my cry, O God. Attend to my prayer. From the end of the earth I will cry to you when my heart is overwhelmed. Lead me to the rock that is higher than I. Now the Hebrew word otaf, translated here as overwhelmed, comes from a primitive root meaning shroud, to cover over, hence the idea of darkness. A shroud is a burial garment. It can also be translated to languish, to faint, or to swoon. So here we see the psalmist felt overwhelmed. You know, there are times in our life when things look rather dark. Yes, sooner or later, we all will experience times in our life when it feels like we're being hit with one wave after another and are about to drown spiritually. If you've ever been to the beach when the waves were really strong, it's easy to get knocked off your feet by a big wave. The time, you know, you get control of the situation and regain your footing, here comes another one, boom, and knocks you back off your feet again, one after the other. That's sometimes the way life feels, doesn't it? Just bang, bang, you know. And sometimes a riptide grabs you and starts to suck you off your feet out into the open sea. And riptides, of course, are so strong that trying to swim back to directly to shore against the riptide current will only tire you out, make it much more difficult for you to survive. Actually, it's not that uncommon for Christians to feel overwhelmed by life circumstances at times. You know, there are spiritual riptides that can manifest themselves very quickly. And when we feel faint, yes, overwhelmed, so we fight against them. You know, I'm thinking about this, and I thought about Jonah. Recall that Jonah experienced physically, he was thrown into the sea. He was drowning, literally drowning. He was overwhelmed, and the dark waters began to cover him like a shroud. Turn over to Jonah, the book of Jonah, and we'll start in chapter 1, verse 15, and we're going to read through the end of chapter 1, and then we're going to start in chapter 2 and read through verse 6. So we're going to go to Jonah 1:15 through 2:6. So they picked up Jonah and threw him in the sea. And the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly and offered a sacrifice to the Lord and took vows. Now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. Beginning chapter 2. Then Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the fish's belly. And he said, I cried out to the Lord because of my affliction. And he answered me, out of the belly of Sheol, that is the grave, I cried. And you heard my voice. For you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the flood surrounded me. All your billows and your waves passed over me. See, like a shroud. Then I said, I have been cast out of your sight, yet I will look again toward your holy temple. The waters surrounded me, even to my soul. The deep closed around me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. I went down to the moorings of the mountains. The earth with its bars closed behind me forever. Yet you have brought up my life from the pit, O Lord, my God. Some have speculated that Jonah literally died and was resurrected 3 days later, rather than being alive and breathing inside the fish's belly. We don't know. It doesn't say one way or the other. But the description here is one of someone drowning. Now these verses immediately bring to mind how Christ's wicked generation sought a sign from heaven, and he referred them to the sign of Jonah. Over in Matthew 6 and verse 4, we'll read that. Matthew 16 and verse 4. This is kind of the short version of what Christ said. There's other versions of it in the other Gospels. But it says, a wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign shall be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. And he left them and departed. So, you know, we often think of this as the 3 days and three nights in the tomb. But I think there's a whole lot more parallelism here between what Christ went through and what Jonah went through as a type. You see, the experience of Jonah is a type of what Jesus actually experienced. Picture Jesus being crucified. He sensed his father turning away and leaving him all alone, just as Jonah was all alone in the deep. And just as Jonah, surely Christ must have felt overwhelmed at that point. We see that account in Matthew 27, verse 46. You want to turn over there, read that one verse. Matthew 27:46, it says, "And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice." Maybe like someone drowning would cry out, saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani?" That is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" We get a very detailed account of his suffering in the prophetic 22nd Psalm. Turn over to Psalm 22 and let's read verses 1 through 18. This is so clear. It's so lucid as to what Christ must have experienced. Prophetic Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me and from the words of my groaning? Oh, my God, I cry in the daytime, but you do not hear. And in the night season, and am not silent, but you are holy, enthroned in the praises of Israel. Our fathers trusted in you. They trusted and you delivered them. They cried to you and were delivered. They trusted in you and were not ashamed. But I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised by the people. All those who see me ridicule me. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head saying, he trusted in the Lord. Let him rescue him. Let him deliver him since he delights in him. But you are he who took me out of the womb. You made me trust while on my mother's breast. I was cast upon you from birth, from my mother's womb. You have been my God. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They gape at me with their mouths like a raging and roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue clings to my jaws. You have brought me to the dust of death. For dogs have surrounded me. The congregation of the wicked has enclosed me. They pierce my hands and my feet. I count all my bones. They look and stare at me. They divide my garments among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots. Now, what a powerful picture this presents to us. Jesus Christ, while he was paying the price for our sins. So let me ask this question. Why do bad things happen to good people? Why is it that Christians are sometimes tried to the point of being overwhelmed? Even more important, how do we respond when that happens to us? When things just don't seem to make sense? You know, life can seem so unfair at times. You hear these young people saying, "That's not fair, that's not fair." Well, newsflash, life is not fair. It's just life. John F. Kennedy. So how does God expect us to cope with severe trials such as cancer, kidney failure, heart disease, sudden infant death syndrome, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, divorce, rape, loneliness, rejection, betrayal, business failure, infertility, or widowhood, just to name a few? Does the Bible give us direction regarding how to respond to sickness, death, or catastrophic loss. Yes, it does. You know, many professing Christians have false expectations about the Christian life. They've allowed themselves to be seduced by Satan's health and wealth prosperity gospel. You know, such a gospel is very popular, and preachers like Joel Osteen have been able to attract many followers with the prosperity gospel message. The prosperity gospel is much like all other religions in that it uses faith and doing good things to leverage material blessings from God. Essentially, it promotes using God to get good things from God. However, such a message is really another gospel, not from Jesus Christ and God the Father. That false message sets people up for unmet expectations. And such unmet expectations are a trigger for wrong emotional responses. False expectations can eventually lead to disillusionment, anger, bitterness, yes, and even blasphemy. Some begin to judge and blame God when they experience difficult circumstances. They question whether God really cares or is even aware of their trial. They allow Satan to take hold of their mind and bring an accusation against God himself. They see God as failing his part of the prosperity gospel bargain. When life gets turned upside down and makes no sense, how should we respond? Is there actually a very valid reason for such suffering in our lives? You know, we may not know the specifics as to why a trial has come upon us, but we can certainly know generally that such trials do have a very important purpose in God's plan for us. Yes, God also understands that we are not yet spirit, but just flesh. And he understands that during such trials, we may feel overwhelmed. As the psalmist wrote in Psalm 78 and verse 39, he said, "For he remembered that they were but flesh, a breath that passes away and does not come again." Yes, God understands we are but flesh. You know, we've probably heard a number of sermons about Job, how he suffered, and the lesson he learned. However, there's another part of the story that is addressed far less often. And that's the lesson we can learn from the response of Job's wife. First, let's turn and read what happened to Job. As we read, keep in mind that Job was married, he had a wife, and his wife also suffered the same great physical losses that Job experienced. True, she was not covered with boils, but she had to watch her husband go through excruciating, agonizing pain and suffering. So let's start at Job 1 and verse 1. And we're going to continue reading through Job 2, verse 10. Job 1, 1 through Job 2, 10. So this gives us a pretty good picture of what Job's going through. Job 1, 1. "There was a man in the land of Uz." You notice he wasn't an Israelite, interestingly. "Whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil." So he was living as a good person. "And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. And his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did regularly. So he was wanting to keep his children in good stead with God as well. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where do you come from?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now, stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. And there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels, took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone escaped to tell you." Just like those waves, one right after the other, bang, bang, bang. And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshiped. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. Job 2, verse 1. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he's in your hand, but spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. And here we go. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? And all this Job did not sin with his lips. So there we have the picture. You know, we don't know the name of Job's wife. We'll call her Mrs. Job. It's never revealed. And yet she is often considered to be one of the most infamous women in the Bible. She's often placed in the same category with Lot's wife due to her speaking out to her husband in the manner she did. Augustine labeled her the devil's accomplice. Calvin called her a diabolical fury. The contemporary understanding of Job's wife hasn't really improved on Calvin or Augustine. It's difficult to find a book or sermon treatment of the life of Job that doesn't include the usual condemnation toward his wife. It has become a standard joke to pity Job as if his wife was yet another cross God called him to bear. Daniel Darling, writing in Today's Christian Woman, had this to say, quote, if the Proverbs 31 woman represents a model of Christian virtue, the wife of Job occupies the role of least desirable, sharing space in the hall of shame with the likes of Jezebel, Delilah, and Michael, end of quote. But is this image an honest assessment of her character? Or is there possibly something else here? Is it possible that in our rush to empathize and identify with Job, we've rushed to cast judgment on his wife? Let's consider that. When I read Daniel Darling's article, I decided to do some digging to see if Job's wife really was as bad as most think. Was there another side to the story which is often overlooked and which actually can give us encouragement? What I found was very enlightening and ties right in with the issue of being overwhelmed, which I'm addressing today. One could argue that every hardship endured by Job was similarly felt by his wife. Could it be that Job's wife, having suffered so much loss and heartache, was simply temporarily overwhelmed? Had her feet been grabbed by a spiritual riptide and she was temporarily swept away? Was she in need of a spiritual lifeguard to pull her back to the spiritual shore and sure footing? Notice that Job did not say she was a foolish woman. He said, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. And there is a big difference. Have any of us, under extreme stress of a trial, spoken things we later regretted? No. Not a one. In a moment of weakness, have we ever allowed ourselves to lose our spiritual footing? You know, we certainly are flesh and not spirit. We certainly are capable of having a lapse in our spiritual strength under times of distress, pain, or prolonged lack of sleep. Sometimes we need someone to point us back in the right direction. And in such times of stress, we often are also needing comfort, not condemnation. Think of all the things the Apostle Paul suffered. Let's read his description of that in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 23 through 28. 2 Corinthians 11, verses 23 through 28. Yes, Paul suffered an awful lot. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. In labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often. From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. Of course, they always only gave 39 in case they'd miscounted because it was illegal to go past 40. 3 times I was beaten with rods. I don't think I'd want to be beaten even once with rods. Once I was stoned. Now, when people stone someone, they're usually dead when they're finished stoning them. So it's very possible that Paul may have actually died and been resurrected. Doesn't say it, but most people who stone don't walk away till you're dead, okay? So he was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day have been in the deep. Yes, like Jonah, covered with that shroud of water. You know, there's nothing more scary than being out in the ocean by yourself with all those sharkies floating around, you know. In journeys often, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea. Yes, it's pretty scary out there, floating around. In perils among false brethren, in weariness, you see, and toil. And yes, remember I mentioned in sleeplessness often. Yes, lack of sleep. In hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. Besides the other things, what comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. So one could say that what Paul experienced was like a New Testament Job in many ways. I don't know if you ever thought of that, but there's kind of a parallel there. Don't you imagine that sometimes during all these trials, Paul might have felt a little bit overwhelmed? We're going to see that he did. Paul was human just like we are. I imagine that at times he needed someone to comfort him and keep him focused on God's plan for his life. Maybe he was thinking about such a need when he penned the following in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 3 through 8. Let's turn over there. 2 Corinthians 1, verses 3 through 8. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of all, Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also abounds through Christ. Now, if we are afflicted, it is for your consolation and salvation, which is effective for enduring the same sufferings which we also suffer. If we are comforted, it is for your consolation and salvation, And our hope for you is steadfast because we know that as you are partakers of the sufferings, so also you are partakers of the consolation. For we do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, of our trouble which came to us in Asia. Now notice this. He's setting you up for the conclusion here. That we were burdened beyond measure, above strength, so that we despaired even of life. Listen carefully to what Paul is saying. Paul is saying his burden was at times overwhelming, even to the point of despairing even of life. Let's take a look at the book of Job from his wife's perspective now and glean some nuggets that God has hidden there for us. As I mentioned in preparation of this sermon, I found a book that was helpful and read it, titled Job's Wife, The Untold Story of a Woman Caught in Life's Adversity by Ruth Ellen Zuber, Z-U-B-E-R, Westbow Press, 2013. So let's stop for a moment and consider all that has happened to Job in a very brief period of time. He has lost his complete livelihood and all his children. You know, this is a major catastrophe. But let's not forget Job's wife. I'm sure by now all the news has reached her as well. Let's move into the house and see how she's dealing with all this chaos. Let's imagine some of the emotions that Job's wife may have been experiencing. I would say there was major grief. Perhaps she was inconsolable. Consider this. Not only had she too lost all their animals and servants, but she too had lost all 10 of her children at one time. Now, I can't relate to how devastating that would be. Naturally, we don't expect to bury one child, let alone 10 children. You know, a number of years ago, I was visiting a church out of state. I was working on my dissertation up in Illinois. And I had the opportunity to meet a man and take him with me to church. And this man had lost all his grown children in a single horrific automobile accident. The children were all traveling in a van and all were killed. I think there's about 6 of them. And even though it had happened in the distant past, I could still hear the anguish in the man's voice as he described the event to me as I drove him to Sabbath service. Never have forgotten it. I'm sure there was fear and bewilderment in Job's wife as she considered all that had occurred. Her whole life was being turned upside down and Job's entire livelihood was destroyed. How would they survive? They had gone from being very wealthy and affluent to having absolutely nothing. All in one day. Can you just hear Satan whispering his lies in her ear? Don't forget, he's out there working this whole situation.
You have nothing left. No one is going to help you. God has abandoned you. Your life has no meaning.
Just hear him saying that. These negative thoughts are multiplying in her mind, and as they do, the situation seems more and more hopeless to her. Possible thoughts like, here I am trying to deal with all this loss by myself while my husband is sitting out there on that ash heap. Why is he not in here helping me cope with all this? What will people say if they see him like this? How will I survive this? Why is this happening? She was probably scared, lonely, grieving, insecure, and maybe even angry, all at the same time. Satan next causes painful boils to form all over Job's body. Now, he's not only sitting on the ash heap, he's out there scraping his sores with a piece of broken pottery. Possibly his wife is looking through a window at her husband, and somewhere deep inside, she's experiencing embarrassment and humiliation at this sight. They've gone from being highly respected, very wealthy, to questionable and destitute in a short moment of time. Her husband, in his current state, is but one more thing that adds to their disaster. Her strength is spent, and she feels she can't handle anything else. Self-pity is taking over her emotions. She swoons with grief and a feeling of abandonment. Godly thoughts have gone out the window. Caught in this spiritual riptide, she spirals from negative thought to negative thought, and with each one she feels worse, more helpless, more angry. She's humiliated, devastated, frustrated, and possibly overwhelmed with shame. Finally, as the thoughts persist, she can hold her silence no more. She marches out to where her husband is sitting, and all those pent-up emotions come rushing forth. Job's wife blurts out in anger, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." Did Job's wife really mean for Job to curse God and die? It's possible that in the heat of the moment that she did, but in actuality, probably not. Remember who is really working behind the scene. Satan has touched Job's body with boils. Satan was doing his level best to get to Job. So what better way to strike the final blow than to plant negative thoughts and feelings of self-pity in his wife? Satan had her so worked up that she didn't take time to think through what she was doing. Have you ever been there? Being overwhelmed is similar to drowning. The dictionary defines overwhelmed one way as the following: to surge over and submerge, to engulf. And what does a drowning man do? He grabs at anything, including a person trying to save him. If swimmers could be trained to be cool under all circumstances, there'd be comparatively little drowning. However, most don't remain cool and calm. If a lifeguard dashes out to the drowning man while he's struggling and attempts to carry him out, the lifesaver must avoid being grabbed, pulled down, and drowned with the man. And just like a drowning man, when we are overwhelmed, we tend to do things that are contrary to what is best for us, or what we would decide to do if we were cool, calm, and collected. Have you ever gotten so emotionally worked up that you blurted something out of your mouth that you wish you could take back? Or maybe you just typed an email and flamed someone in the heat of the moment. A flame message is an extremely critical or abusive electronic mail message or posting in a public forum. If you've done any of that, I have. Congratulations, you're part of the sinful human race. I imagine that after Job's wife lashed out at him, Job realized how difficult this must be for her too. I also think he is hurt that she should say such a thing to him. But with his answer, he redirects her attention back to God. Just like a lifesaver helping a drowning person. "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" All this, Job did not sin with his lips. You know, self-pity is a powerful tool that Satan uses against us. We begin to think only of ourselves and how we are feeling without regard to how others may also be suffering or how we are impacting them. In our current narcissistic culture, empathy is greatly lacking. As the spiritual leader of his family, Job speaks from his brokenness to stop the self-pity and incorrect thinking. He reminds his wife of the reality that God is in control of everything, and above all, they need to trust and rely on him regardless of the circumstances. That's the message. You know, this is very much like what we find in the New Testament in 2 Corinthians 10, verse 5. Turn over there. In 2 Corinthians 10, verse 5. This pretty much describes what Job was doing to help his wife. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 5. Casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. In other words, we are to measure our thoughts against what God tells us in His Word. When Satan sneaks a lie or a thought of self-pity into our thoughts, we need to compare it to what we know is the truth according to God's Word. That is our great defense against being irreversibly overwhelmed. There's a difference between temporarily being overwhelmed and irreversibly being overwhelmed. I'm sure that in the midst of many sleepless nights, Job's wife tried to make sense of the numbness she felt. She may have moved about her home from window to window, longing for a sign of her children returning, only to realize once more that they were not coming back. From time to time, she may have caught glimpses of her husband watching his anguish as he sat in the ashes scraping his boils. She probably ached inside knowing that she had added to his grief when she lashed out at him. Job felt abandoned and alone as he looked at his festering sores. I imagine his wife felt that way as well. I believe Job's epic struggle was recorded to help us get through the storms in our lives. For even in the midst of his great crisis, Job never lost faith in God. We see this in Job's powerful declaration in Job 19, verses 25 and 26. Job 19, verses 25 and 26. Probably some of you know this by heart. For I know that my Redeemer lives, that he shall stand at the last on the earth, and after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God. God did not leave Job in a mess. There is, as Paul Harvey would say, a rest of the story. God eventually blesses Job again with much more than he had before. Turn over to Job 42 and verse 10. Job 42 and verse 10. Here it says, and the Lord restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends. Notice there was this outgoing concern. He wasn't praying for himself. He was praying for his friends. Indeed, the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. In Job 42, verses 12 In 13 we read, "Now the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. For he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 female donkeys. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters." Again, the Bible's silent about Job's wife at the end of Job's trial. Some speculate that Job eventually got another wife. But one can't defend that position from silence. I prefer to believe that life in the house of Job began to awaken again as friends and family began to show up. You can imagine his wife's excitement as she pulled back the heavy curtains on the windows and let the light of hope shine through. Her husband was back in good health and had actually grown in knowledge of his Creator. There may have been issues between her and Job based on her explosive statement, but as with any marriage that lasts, they would have worked through it. The glimpses we saw of Job's character imply that he would have shown grace and mercy to his wife in the form of understanding and forgiveness. They probably had a good relationship, and a few spiteful words spoken in the midst of overwhelming trouble would not have broken it. I imagine that she was a beautiful woman. And as the stress of life began to lift, she would have found joy in being with her husband once again. They became new parents again, including having the most beautiful daughters one can imagine. Over in Job 42 and verse 15, 42:15, it states, "In all the land were found no women so beautiful as the daughters of Job." Do you suppose they looked like their mama? I like to think so. Chapter 42 of the book of Job ends by telling us that Job lived 140 years and saw his sons and his sons' sons, even 4 generations. Unlike Lot's wife, who turned back and became a pillar of salt, Job's wife was blessed with beautiful children, grandchildren, and even great-grandchildren. So what should we take away from this brief examination of Mr. and Mrs. Job and their trials? Our God loves us as dear children. Yes, He allows us to be tested and tried and to even suffer. Sometimes that suffering is very great. But all that He allows will work for our eternal good if we remain faithful to Him. Jeremiah 29 and verse 11. Turn over to Jeremiah 29 and verse 11. And we see a glimpse into the heart of God. Jeremiah 29:11. It says, "For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says the Eternal. Thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you a future and a hope." That's how God sees it. I believe these words not only apply to ancient Israel, but to each of us individually as well, who are His called out children. So, there was so much more that I wanted to add to this sermon, probably another hour. But, you know, I don't want our end to be worse than our beginning. So let's close with some very encouraging words of Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ who certainly was very acquainted with hardships and trials. Over in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, let's read verses 16 through 18 together. 2 Corinthians 4, verses 16 through 18. Here's a man who suffered greatly, had many, many trials, In 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16, he says, therefore we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, remember what Paul went through, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, including our own flesh suffering, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal.